ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We've adjusted our board on young Ida. You won't do better.
It's a grey, drizzly day in Melbourne. An excited crowd jostles around the parade ring for a good squeeze at the horses, about to race the Caulfield Cup. Ladies lining up for fashions on the field, while gents avail themselves of a beverage. Or four or five. And bookies shout their odds to the punters.
Right now, 3-1 for the cup.
The race is on.
Welcome, Grand Scarlet. Here comes Grand Sidium down the outside with 100 metres left to go. 12 time in front of Gala Supreme. In third place in Young Ida and Grand Sidium. But 12 time in front near the line. And 12 time in front of Tom Gala Supreme.
Malcolm McCarroll was a mad punter. Loved betting on horses.
650 k's away from the heaving Caulfield Cup crowds. 18-year-old Mick Dolman and eight other men are wet, cold and cramped in the vast ocean off Tasmania.
So Malcolm says, I got a fair idea what the field is.
Malcolm was a curly-haired young man with a cheeky smile, and he had $10 on that race.
I'll rattle the razor off and you pick which horse you want.
So there, in an emergency life raft, not a horse in sight, these men race the Caulfield Cup, cheering on their horse to the finish.
I can't remember now what horse I picked.
Suffice to say, he didn't win.
You've got to keep your spirits up. You've got to find a way to unblock where you are and what's happening. Because there's always something going on.
The crew of the Blythe Star were now well past the point at which all the experts said they should have died. But here they were, hanging in there.
We're in a desperate situation, so you just haven't got time to, you know, think of anything other than surviving and getting out of this bloody mess.
This is Expanse, Season 2, Episode 4. Missing, presumed dead. Days into their ordeal, the crew of the Blythe Star kept a constant lookout, desperate for a glimpse of another ship to save them.
It was late night. It would probably be 11 o'clock at night, something in that order. We were all just sitting around in the raft. Ken Jones was doing the lookouts.
Ken Jones, heartbreaker and natural-born leader, had taken Mick under his wing, always with an encouraging word.
You would stand up in the raft and the canopy, you'd open it up and just have your head sticking out of it so you could see what's going on. And then he put his head down into the raft and said, there's fishing boats out here. He was chafing at the bit. And so were we, because we're in the canopy, so we can't see anything. And we're dying to bloody have a look. But there's only room for one.
This news is electric. This is their chance to be saved. Two of them grab the paddles and try to get closer.
And the only fishing boats that were around that area at the time were these Japanese fishing boats. They had a mothership and they used to have a heap of fishing vessels. So Ken went back up and he said, I'm going to put the flare out. So he done the flare.
He rips open a handheld flare. It burns molten in the darkness. Mick can see it through the canopy as the acrid burnt smell reaches his nostrils. Ken gripped desperately onto the burning tube as it burned his hand and forearm.
A short period after that, he came back into the raft and said, they've turned and gone. Gone away. We were convinced that the Japanese seafarers had left us because they were poaching in the domestic waters. We were deeply depressed. How could a seafarer leave other seafarers in a life raft?
It was these moments when Ken Jones would haul the others out of depression, inspiring, cajoling and encouraging them to just stick it out.
He'd build your confidence because of his confidence and you entrusted in him his judgment on all things. I think we would have all got out of there without his intervention and engagement.
What would you say to yourself when things were at their worst and there were those really low moments?
Probably say to myself, I wish I wasn't bloody here. You just roll with the punches and hope that everybody's in the same frame of mind as you are if we need all hands on deck to save ourselves.
The men's drift continued. The wind that had started by blowing them ever further south had switched around and pushed them back toward Tasmania. The land loomed and then disappeared on the horizon as they were pushed around with the current and winds. By Caulfield Cup Day, they could spot Tasman Lighthouse, perched at the very bottom of the Tasman Peninsula, an austere finger of land dripping off Tasmania's southeast. The colonisers 200 years ago housed the worst convicts here. It's such a savage place. Mother Nature was better than any jailer. If they escape, let them try their luck in the impenetrable scrub, or else take their chances with the sharks. But still, it's land.
On one occasion, Malcolm McCarroll wanted to swim to Tasman Island, where the lighthouse is. We're using reflectors and all sorts of things to try and get their attention, but never got their attention. And Malcolm said, I'll tell you what, I reckon I could swim to that loading dock. I said, are you serious? He said, yeah, I'm a reasonable swimmer. I said, mate, that's a long way, and you're not in your fit condition. That's really risky stuff. He said, no, I think I can do it. I said, mate, if you swim with a rope wrapped around you to that landing, what happens if a shark gets you? He's only going to come back and find out that there's more of us in the raft, and you'll be the appetite and we'll be the main course and the dessert. So we gave that a bit of thought, and he said, no, you're probably right, we'd better not do that.
By now, the Pizza Hut in Springvale, where Mick and Joni had started their unlikely romance, was a long way away. Joni had been waiting days for news that Mick had been found after his ship had disappeared without a trace.
Towards the end, Mick's mum was convinced that Mick was not coming back. In the end, didn't matter what anybody said.
Instead of talking about where they'd go out next weekend, Joni was sitting in Mick's family living room, wondering if she'd ever see him again.
There was a pool table in the middle of the lounge room. It was the best thing, and it did keep everybody sane through some of the hard days. They'd have a game of pool and just try and keep their mind off what was going on at the time.
The house was packed day after day. People all perched on the couch and chairs around the pool table, clinging on to what hope they could. A fog of smoke hanging over everything as people soothed their nerves with cigarettes.
We were all watching the news when something was said about the search has been called off.
The nine-day air search for the Blythe Star and its crew of 10 was called off today. Mr.
Chris Lang. And we all looked at each other. We couldn't believe it when we heard that. I remember you could hear a pin drop in their home. That was devastating. We couldn't believe it. So Tommy, his dad, rang people to find out if it was true. And of course it was. I thought, oh my God, maybe Mick has died. He's not going to come back. Maybe the ship did sink and they have gone down with the ship. There was a lot of people there crying, his mum, his sisters, my sisters, everyone. Everyone was crying, and then that turned into anger.
Mick's dad, Tommy, was having none of it.
He said, well, I'm not giving up, Joni. And he just wouldn't give up. I just left him because he was angry at the time, very angry that day, and angry for days after. And each day was just horrible, couldn't function properly. Everybody still went to the Dolman home. I don't think they knew what else to do, where else to go. And that's all I wanted to do was be there with them. I felt while I was with them, I was close to Mick. Dufton just went into mourning.
One of their own had been lost at sea, declared dead. It was over for Mick. 16-year-old Robin Simpson remembers her mum getting the call, saying that her dad, Alf, cook on the ship, was missing, presumed dead.
I could hear her saying, no, no, why? And I said, what's wrong, Mum? What's happening? And she told me, she said, they've called the search off for your father and we have to presume he's dead. And I just ran to her and gave her a hug.
Robin's mum started calling around to break the news and then started organising a memorial service for Alf, all on the advice of the authorities.
For the sake of the family, it would be best to have a memorial service.
Having plans for a memorial service in place, it must have seemed very final, I imagine.
Well, yes, it was, and that was hard, but that was what they told us to do, because when there's no bodies, you don't know what happened. You have to have closure. You can't move on if you don't.
How on earth did you begin to process that news that your dad is lost, presumed dead?
It's just, I think you sort of, like you're in a dream, like it's so unreal, and it's like you're in another world, and you're going on automatic pilot. Someone would come and you don't even know they're there because, you know, you're just out of it.
And 10 3/4-year-old Mark Eagles, he was still hanging on to hope that his dad, John Eagles, who loved opera and tinkering with Land Rovers, was okay.
We were still under the hope that dad would be found, or the ship and the crew would be found. We never switched off that. I never did anyway.
By now, the remaining shipwrecked crew could see land periodically. They'd paddle like madmen to get close during the day, and then the night would steal them back out to sea. But these views of land were still a glimmer of hope.
It was comforting because, you know, you're not lost completely to the world.
It had been a really long week, stuck together in this god-awful raft, floating around, getting hungrier and thirstier and colder.
There was one point not far from the Tasman Island, these big pinnacles that come out of the sea, they're huge. And Mick Powell was paddling and said, look, you better have a look at this. We're getting too close to these rocks.
What Mick Powell was looking at were rocks that could shred the life raft and pulverise the men inside. I've seen them. They're sheer, and there's no clambering up them at the best of times.
I said, no, it was a beautiful day. It was almost like a sailing day. So I went to the opening of the canopy, and to my horror, we were that close that you could almost touch these pinnacles.
6-metre waves were relentlessly drawing them toward these rock pillars, crashing on them with enormous force.
And I got the other paddle and we paddled like mad. You'd get right up to the opening to lean out of the raft and you'd be 2 abreast and you would dig deep into the water with your paddle. They're not designed for that type of activity, but one point said to him, do you think we can fit through that gap between the two of them? No, he said, no way. But we just got to paddle hard. And I was cramped up in my hamstrings and calf muscles, really screaming for pain. And we got around these pinnacles. Huge.
They'd just skirted disaster again and were floating now in a bay.
Both Mick and I collapsed with exhaustion and asked a couple of others to have a paddle, of which they didn't bother. And we blew back out to sea. That was a day where the mayhem in the raft was potentially possible because I won't mention who they were, but these two blokes wouldn't paddle. and I was filthy on it. And I don't know whether that would have made much difference in terms of getting further into that bay, but they didn't. And all of us felt shitty about the whole thing. And we were really getting to the end of the tether.
It's hardly surprising tempers started fraying. Honestly, it's more surprising the group hadn't cannibalised itself already.
Exhaustion, fatigue, no water, no food. We were getting very, very close. And some of the older guys were not very well at all.
At this point, the men's bodies were on the point of collapse. Ken Jones was trying his best to get everyone to take a stint on the paddles. It's impossible to know why two of them refused to pick them up. Out of respect to their families, Mick didn't want to name and shame. Though in researching this story, the records are pretty clear. And one of those two men was also someone who, in another moment, had done something incredibly brave. But in this moment, they left their crewmates hanging. Maybe they'd given themselves up for dead already. Maybe they just didn't have the strength. Or maybe we're all many things in different moments. And we all have a breaking point. Whatever the reason, they missed that opportunity to make it into land.
Anyway, we drifted, and then we saw what looked like a road along the foreshore. We paddled right into it, then realised it wasn't a road. It's a rock formation that looked like a road. And now we were being pushed onto the rocks to be chopped up again. And we spent all night, hanging on to kelp and seagrass to keep us in shape.
The next morning was clear and calm.
We had shifted considerable way up the coast, and most of us were non-compos mentis, just completely gone. I came to, and there was Deep Glen Bay.
Deep Glen Bay. I feel like bay gives the wrong impression here. A small inlet on Tasmania's east coast. It's surrounded by vertical rock faces. The short beach? Well, it's more a collection of coffee table-sized boulders. And the hill behind is this dense, wet scrub at a mean vertical angle.
We ended up being washed up on the rocks. I jumped into the water because we were that close to the rocks. And Mick Power also jumped in. And I think Alka McCarroll was third. And we pulled the raft up onto the rocks.
For the first time in 9 days, Mick's feet had solid land under them.
We realised that we couldn't stand up, we couldn't walk, couldn't move, and we kept collapsing because our legs had lost their functionality because we were in a rubber raft bouncing around for all those days.
Mick and the other 8 men weren't going to let that stop them from getting ashore after all this time. They're on hands and knees.
It took time for us to crawl over to a more hospitable bit of grass, and thankfully, a freshwater stream, of which we drank plenty of. That's the only bit of luck we had in landing there to have a water supply, because once we had surveyed our location, we realised that we're out of the fat and into the fire, because it was just hundreds of metres high, all the coastline, near impossible to get out.
The 9 crew left from the devastated Blythe Star had finally made it to land. But they didn't seem to be a great deal better off. No sign of human habitation for donkeys. Their bodies wasted away. Chief Engineer John Eagles, still sporting a burn on his lower leg from shutting off the engine as the ship sank. Ken Jones, with a gash on his face from swimming out of his submerged cabin. Now, how the hell were they going to get out of this pit of a bay?
How did you feel looking up at that incredibly inhospitable and daunting challenge that lay ahead of you to get out?
Yes, well, it was daunting. I made the decision that I was the youngest and the fittest, I think, and I said, I'll come back when I find something. So Stan Leary gave me a $10 note, which he said, if you see a shop, will you get a carton of cigarettes for me? So I put the $10 note down me jocks because I never had any pants or anything, and off I went.
Mick spent hours trying to scale the near vertical scrub, pushing his way through bush that tore at the skin and seemed like a solid wall, more so than a collection of plants.
Couldn't get anywhere, so I came back. And later that afternoon, we had another crack.
Unofficial leader of the marooned crew, Ken Jones, along with rock star lookalike Mick Power and young Mick Dolman, rallied themselves for another assault on the terrain.
We tried the other side. Same thing, too difficult. Mick Power fell when he was trying to climb.
They were in no fit state to be copping falls. Mick Power now had a suspected punctured lung and broken ankle. And the cook, Alf Simpson, was carrying injuries from another failed attempt. Some of them start thinking, maybe we're going to have to get back into that raft to find somewhere more hospitable to land.
I'm not critical of whoever said it. I'm pretty sure it was the chief engineer. And I said, you're kidding. I'm not getting back in that raft for anything.
Mick's dead serious. That is not going to happen.
And I got my knife and started to cut it up.
So that option's out, which I imagine can't have gone down brilliantly with all the other crew. The men try again and again to find a way.
No success, and we all came back. And then we took a break and said, well, look, let's lay down and rest for a day. Have 24 hours, just chill out, get the fresh water into us, and we'll see what we could do. A little bit comatose and worn out. People were dreaming and hallucinating and yelling out in their sleep.
That night must have been quite a long, difficult night then.
Yeah, it was. And we had no fire. We had no ability to light a fire. So it was just constantly cold.
Next day, Ken Jones, who's got his love Fran and a four-year-old daughter waiting at home, asks Mick to have yet another crack at trying to find a weakness in the landscape to get out.
I failed again. I couldn't get out. Then I came back. I said to one of the guys, where's Ken? They said, he's over there, on that rock over there. I went over and there was Ken sitting on the rock looking out to sea, and he was dead.
Ken had stripped off his jumper as one of his last acts, and he sat there in the chilly breeze as though just having a rest.
He'd died of exhaustion. I was so shocked. He was the last I would have rated to die at Deep Glen Bay. Just couldn't believe it. It was really, really sad.
Then Mick catches sight of the chief engineer, dad of the 10 3/4-year-old Mark, John Eagles.
I then went down to the ocean where the raft was, and the chief engineer had died also. And he was getting washed up and down in the wash of the waves, and I pulled him up onto the shoreline to keep him clear of that.
Just like Ken and his jumper, John Eagles had taken his overalls off in his last moments. It might seem strange, but I've spoken to experts, and it's actually not unusual for people suffering hypothermia. It's called paradoxical undressing,
And basically, the body's temperature is so low that the brain can't make sense of what it's feeling and mistakes the extreme cold feeling as hot. While the crew were in their covered life raft, they at least had some shared body heat. Now, out in the open and spread out, that heat evaporates instantly. It was later found that Ken Jones also had acute pulmonary edema, basically fluid on the lungs, which would have been a 000 call if he was at home. And his organs were so stressed, they were nowhere near the size they should have been. And there's another reason why the body might suddenly shut down after all these days of acute stress. A survival expert I've spoken to, remember Dr. Nicole Anderson? Well, she says that the fight, flight, and stress response these men had been living with for days now pumps up your heart rate and blood pressure.
The relief of hitting land could actually deplete the stress response that was actually keeping them alive all that time.
That relief might have meant their blood pressure and heart rate plunged dangerously. And in their depleted state, dehydrated, fatigued, it could have been fatal. Time has run out for the men. After all they've been through, their bodies are shutting down. And Mick knows it.
If we don't get help, there's going to be more of these blokes dead in the next few days. So Malcolm McCarroll and myself had a bit of a chat and we said we're going to walk out and we'll keep going to the point that we'll either die trying or get help.
This is From the Dead, Season 2 of Expanse, made on Awabakal land and the land of the Stony Creek Nations. Hosted by me, Pia Wursu. My producer and sound engineer is the unparalleled Grant Walter. Executive producer is Blythe Moore. Senior producer is me. With thanks to Liz Gwynn and Helen Shield for additional production and research. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hey, it's Anne Jones and we're back with a whole new season of What the Duck Moments from the Natural World.
With the California condors, one of the reasons why they were in so much trouble is because of Johnny Cash.
Really?
Yes.
Find brand new episodes of What the Duck on the ABC Listen app.